It's kind of like when you come on a retreat, oftentimes I feel like, you know, it's when, you know, sort of like it's been here kind of rainy and you're driving and the light turns red and, you know, you put the brakes on and all of a sudden our lives, boom, you know, all that we were doing, you might feel all those recycling cans in the back, the car kind of rattling around and hands gripping on the steering wheel, like kind of wondering, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? And then the car, most of the time, you know, comes to the stop because luckily you have attended to the brakes and whatnot. And that's sort of like what happens to us, you know, in our lives, and we're going along and we end up here together with this commitment to practice, to create this community. And so I really wanted to invoke the word sacred, this sacred task. Sacred comes from the word holy. And if we think of whole, like we're bringing our whole selves here. And when the monastics, when they went forth into their life, it was like to living the holy life. And so we are engaging in this practice of, you know, living the holy life, bringing our whole selves to this practice. And as we did last night, we're supported by all of the Buddhist teachings, particularly the ones that we talked about last night around sila, ethics and integrity, and beauty and kindness. And so I'm going to be going through a little bit more some of those practices, focusing on the refuges that Mary Grace introduced us to, and we all chanted them so beautifully last night. And so we are creating and weaving this tapestry together of the retreat. And I specifically want to talk about these because I have found them to be such a support for me. So in addition to the ritual that happened last night, just the way that we can bring them in to our day-to-day practice to support us. So, you know, just a real practical way to start off is I often chant the refuges. And so this is something that I have done sometimes, like just the mind needs something to hold on to. And so whether it's in Pali, the language that the Buddhist teachings were written down in, or in English, but just like I go to refuge, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, just to remind myself, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And partly I bring them in because it's a way to dispel this notion of the me here that's in control of everything. Right. You know, here, one of the really big things is like, we get fed these amazing meals. And yet, there can be this way of wanting exactly what I want for lunch or dinner or breakfast. And so we can let go of control by bringing these ideas, these rituals of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the three refuges. And they remind us of this possibility of freedom. Because too often, I feel like in our lives, we think that freedom comes from organizing our lives the way we want them to do. And then when we realize that, then we add in the shame and the blame because lives aren't working the way we want. And so the three refuges can be a different orientation to that. And also, I really think of the refuges as this way that we say to each other and to ourselves, I see your beauty. You know, this way, I see your beauty. I see beyond all of these constructs. I see your beauty, and I want to support your dedication to liberation, to freedom, to waking up. And then I see your generosity. All of us have come here and are having to give to each other. We get this opportunity to practice generosity over and over again. Waiting, waiting, you know, generosity. And just this opportunity to turn towards care and kindness for both ourselves and each other. because this opportunity to see the whole of our lives unfold and again turn towards care and kindness. And so this is a different kind of refuge than what we usually do. This refuge is not based on accumulation. It's not based on getting rid of and separating from, avoiding. It's really based on orienting ourselves in a certain way, orienting ourselves to these refuges. And so we're invited to turn towards. So one of the things, and this is what, when I say those words now, I just do this. It's kind of one of those, somaticizations where, like, oftentimes when something comes up in our world, we're like pushing it away or pulling it towards. And if we just turn towards, it's not like, yay, oh, good, there's no fill in the blank, right? It's just like, okay, can I meet this? So when we turn towards, it's just like a welcoming. And so the refuges, when we bring them in, there are three, but just like so much of the Buddhist teaching, it's like a hologram. And so they weave in and out of themselves. And so I wanted to just sort of go through each one of them and say a little bit about how it showed up for me in my practice and how I think it can support us. So when we first think of the Buddha, we can think of this particular individual. And to me, that's pretty amazing that there was a human who was engaged in this practice. We can also consider there were countless lifetimes, but you don't even have to consider that. You can just consider the Buddha thinking, wow, I want to wake up. I want to live a life free from greed, free from hatred, free from confusion. You know, 2,600 years ago, and he had the same things we had. He got old. He had sickness. There were fights. There were people trying to kill him. Maybe everyone's not trying to kill us right away, but not sometimes in different ways. But, you know, just that he had all of these things to contend with. And he made this decision to turn towards his life in search of this freedom. And the other thing that we know is that he had a relatively comfortable life. You know, behind the walls of, some people call it a palace. Some people say, well, it wasn't really a palace, but, you know, let's just say he lived in a gated community, you know, that he had, you know, his needs met. And he chose to leave, to go out, to give up, to renounce, to give up all, you know, what we would have, your cell phones, your devices. He gave it all up because he wanted to let go and to face what was happening, this freeing the heart and the mind from greed, hatred, and delusion. And through this practice, through this dedication, this practice has come down over 2,600 years. And we are now in that stream. So beginning in Nepal and India and going to Southeast Asia and China and Japan, just think of all the people over those 2,600 years who got up early in the morning or, you know, just were moving in that way of being mindful in each moment, bringing this care. And I think of that because once I was visiting the hermitage, the Aranyabodhi hermitage, which is the Bhikkhuni hermitage up here in Jenner, and there were four nuns there at the time. Only four. It was relatively new, and they had just started there. I think they've been there about 20 years now. And there were only four people there, and I was helping out with making the meals and things. And all I could think of was like, no one's going to know if you don't get up at 5. You know, it's like, can we sleep in, you know? And I was just thinking to myself, like, no one's going to know. And yet it's that dedication. It's that dedication because it's really with each moment of like how I'm going to orient myself. And yet it's not with this like flogging myself. Ah! And yet it is that perseverance. And so there is this sense of determination that we engage in, this courage that we engage in, because we are training the heart. We're training the mind. This is a mind training. And so in order to cut through all of that delusion, we just have to keep coming back again and again. And so there, when I need to think about the inspiration of like, oh, how do I do this? I can just remember this person who made this commitment to keep coming back over and over again. And you could think of countless lifetimes if that supports you as well. And then the Buddha can also be thought of as that capacity within each one of us. Some people call it Buddha nature. You know, you can call it that inner wisdom, whatever you speak to around that. But just that capacity that we have. And this has been really helpful for me because I have not always had a lot of confidence in my own capacity, a lot of self-doubt. And so it's really helpful to me to just like, I don't know, this is one of those jokes from, I grew up Catholic, but just like the, one of those jokes that are like, you know, God's just handing out everything to everybody and, they're, and then, you know, runs out like, oh, sorry, no brains left, you know, over here to this person. That's not here with the Buddha's teachings on, you know, the Buddha nature, that we all have this capacity to awake. We all have this capacity. And so it's just about this dedication of watering the seeds. And so I have been challenged to remember this capacity. But if I can remember, I don't have to awaken now. It's just this intention of watering the seeds. And I don't have to become, you know, this huge oak tree in 1 week or 1 day. But I just have to keep, whoop, water the seed. And so partly for me, that is this way of surrendering to the moment. Just remembering this is the moment and this is the seed and that I'm watering it and I'm in this lineage of practice and I'm not separate from that. I was practicing on a longer retreat at Spirit Rock and as many of you have probably experienced today waiting, and I remember waiting in the line with my dishes to wash them, put them through the window. I'm standing there waiting, holding my dishes, waiting for the line to move. You know, there's really, you know, it's kind of funny what the mind does because what else is there really to do, right? So I was just waiting and not, you know, kind of trying to figure out how do I be mindful here, kind of feeling the weight of the dishes, feeling that all. And so I was remembering, okay, how could I practice in this moment? How could I practice with these dishes rather than just waiting for this line to be over and to be done, you know, which isn't really being in the moment. And so then I thought to myself, I thought, what if I were holding the Buddha's dishes? What if I were in, what if my task were to take the Buddha's dishes to be cleaned? And all of a sudden, I just felt this incredible reverence. Like, whoa, if I held the Buddha's dishes, I would really be holding them differently, right? I was like, wow, I got the Buddha's dishes here. And I could feel them and feel this weightiness of like having the Buddha's dishes and that it was my task to take the Buddha's dishes to the table and scrape the little stuff out of it. And then I had this thought and I realized, oh, right, these are the Buddha's dishes. Like, I have this capacity in me. I have that Buddha. What if I were to treat myself with that reverence? And it was really profound. And I say this because, oh my gosh, that was like while I was waiting in the line for the dishing, right? So it doesn't have to be just in the hall right here, you know, that you're going to have just an insight that will support you or be like a way of orienting. And so it was amazing because when we can pause and we can hold ourselves as sacred, remember how our own beauty, remember how we are honoring ourselves by showing up here. We can think about that. So if we were considering we're sitting in a hall of all of these Buddhas, you know, what beauty, what joy. So to sort of recap to practicing with the refuge of the Buddha. So some of the things that you can do, particularly if you're like, what am I doing? We can remember the historical Buddha, that person with determination, with courage and care, just that over and over again. Or we can remember all the many people who have made this choice to wake up moment by moment. We can remember the lineage. We can remember how the teachings have been passed down, you know, from one person to the other, people just like ourselves. And then we can also remember the seed of the Buddha that we each have, that we are choosing to water by being here, choosing to just incline the heart and mind that way. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, we're taking refuge in that capacity in ourselves, just remembering our liberation, capacity for, to be free. So the second refuge, which we chanted last night, is the refuge in the Dharma. Dharma is the Sanskrit, and then Dhamma. So you'll hear them both kind of D-H-A-M-M-A. That's Pali. So they're kind of both interchangeable. And Mary Grace did an amazing job kind of saying the different aspects of what the Dharma is and the various iterations of it. And once again, you'll see the pointing of this, how the Dharma is a refers to the nature of the way things are outside and beyond how we want the world to be. Beyond our views, beyond our opinions, beyond, you know, the things that we can control, the way things are. You know, for example, like natural laws like gravity. You know, when you drop something, gravity takes it. So we can think of the Dharma as operating on that level, the natural laws. And so one of the images that I think that's helpful when we think of the Dharma is to remember that when we're practicing our mindfulness, which is part of the, you know, bringing our attention and our awareness, that the mind in Pali is often used by the word citta, one of the words, C-I-T-T-A. And it's actually usually more appropriately translated as heart mind. And I bring this in because so often when we sit, when we sit and we practice with our mindfulness, we end up going up into our heads to be mindful, you know, full of our mind. And a lot of what we're doing is getting into the body here. And so I also, because this is the kind of word games I do, I think to myself, do you think this practice would have taken on if they called it heartfulness? Do you think it would have the same oomph? You know, would people be like taking heartfulness classes? And I wonder because, you know, in our society, mind has a certain, you know, intellectual, like if you're mind, but if you're like heart, sometimes you're like, oh, Hallmark, you know, so it's just interesting to think about how we react when we think mindfulness or heartfulness or mind heartfulness can just be a reflection to see where our attention lands. And I think it's helpful to remind ourselves of this because when we think of the Dharma, sometimes we go into this capacity of the knowing mind. This, you know, we orient ourselves by knowing things. We know that's a door. It's good. I can go through it. That's a window. I'm not going to go that way. So it's very, very helpful. And yet we don't always have all the training in this heart mindfulness. And so this orientation towards wholeness and well-being, we can really bring them both in. So this is a sutta that I know Bob loves, and I'm going to share it tonight. And it's from the Rohitasa Sutta, the Anguttara Nikaya. And I also like it because the Rohitasa was a radiant deva. So this deva that came down and visited the Buddha and said to the Buddha, "Dear teacher, is it possible to know or see or reach the end of the world by traveling to a place where there's no being born, growing old, dying, passing away, or being reborn?" You know, can we get there? Can we get to that place where we can just be free from suffering? No aging, no dying, you know, like a cryobank or something, you know, where we just can hold on. And we probably know the Buddha's response. The Buddha says, no, it's not possible to find that place. to reach, to travel there. And then the Buddha continues and says, it is within this fathom-long body, with its perception and mind, that I declare that there is the world, the origination of the world, the cessation of the world, and the path of practice that leads to its cessation. So all, it's not about getting anywhere. It's not about finding the perfect spot. It's about practicing in this fathom-long body, all of it here. So we don't have to transcend the world. So at any point, whatever is showing up, pleasant, unpleasant, you know, we can engage right there. We don't have to abandon the body. The body's feeling achy, the body's feeling achy. If the body's feeling sick, the body's feeling sick. Can we practice right there? Bodies are messy. Bodies are complicated. So that's the way bodies are. And the Buddha just said, in this fathom-long body, all can be revealed. And the other thing that I like about this quote is the Buddha said, in this fathom-long body with its perception and mind, with its perception and mind. And so this word perception, I think, is a really useful one for us to look at, because as we get quiet, a lot of our habit tendencies begin, a lot of our perceptions arise. And so perception is part of the quality of knowing something. So like, for example, I said before, like we can discern that this is the, you know, chair or table or door. So I know this is a chair. I know these are glasses. And so that can seem kind of simple. That's the labeling of naming it. But then we begin to add on all our stories. So we can add on stories about what it means. What does it mean now that I have to wear glasses? You know, what does it mean now that I'm sitting in a chair and not on the floor? What does it mean? These are our perceptions, the stories. And all of these are unfolding as a result of contact with the body. So the body arises. We have these sense doors and we see, smell, hear, taste, touch, think, and then the perception. So we see it and then boom, all the stories before we know it. We're gone, our perceptions. And so our perceptions are based on all sorts of factors in our conditioning, our histories, the cultures. Buddhist teacher, Rob Berbia, who teaches, he passed away last year. He taught at Gaia House in England. And he says, typically, we do not deliberately choose our way of looking at any situation. It is imposed on us rather by the habits of mind. And instead of helping to see the emptiness of things, these habitual ways of looking tend to solidify perceptions and compound dukkha, compound suffering. Most human beings will have experienced many times states in which the mind gets so caught up in a storm of reactivity that the ability to have a spacious perspective has been lost. Sucked into a vortex of unhelpful thinking and viewing, the mind is bound up in one's lens, one way of looking at the solution, and utterly convinced of the truth of what it sees. So oftentimes we will see, hear something, and then immediately we can get sucked into a vortex of like what that means, the whole story. And we often then think that our story is the story that everyone else is thinking. And so it's interesting that the perspective here is, and oftentimes then we can begin to put on like, oh, it's my fault at the end of that. But what we're hearing from this quote from Rob is that we do not deliberately choose this. These are the habits that have come in, conditions that have happened. And so I think that's really important to remember that we each have come here with just all of these causes and conditions based on our schooling, based on the location where we grew up, based on our family, based on society. You know, we have all of these contributions, and then we arrive here, and then we watch them play out on this playground of our practice. So Buddhist teacher Sebane Selassie, who is in New York, she says, from the time we are in the womb, we are absorbing all of the messages of our culture, from conversations, from the way people look at us, from advertising, from kids in the schoolyard, word by word, moment by moment. So have you ever had that happen where all of a sudden you have a memory from something that happened in elementary school? Like, wow, just kind of comes up. Yes, comparing mind is just a natural part of our human condition and something with which we have to contend. But in our society, comparing mind is on the steroids of our educational system, consumerism, the beauty industry, racism, and the racial categories themselves, misogyny, homophobia, ableism, fatphobia, and more. These thoughts are not our fault, and we are still responsible for them, for knowing them, understanding them, and eventually letting go. But we should not blame ourselves for thinking these thoughts. The programming is deep, it's systemic, and it's been going on a long time. And in this, I really like how Sebane points to this way that all of this has come in, and it's not our fault, but what we can do is we can meet them and see it. And then we can be like, oh, maybe it was wise back then in fourth grade when I was playing on the playground to make fun of those other kids because I wanted to be friends with those kids over there. That's the thought that's coming to my mind right now with a memory, boom, that just arose. But I know then the pain that I carry with that, so I can remember that the perceptions and the teachings that I've learned are just that, they're habits. And that has been going on a long time. And so she says, the thoughts are not our fault and we are still responsible for them, for knowing them, understanding them, and eventually letting go. So these systems and structures are part of what we're trying to uproot. And they're kind of just unfold within us and we can begin to pay attention to us, to them. And then when we can get hooked on them is we can end up in this place of judging and blaming. Years ago, and I still, even though the radio, people don't play their radio as much anymore, but a retreat, people, there was somebody, maybe it was Joseph Goldstein at IMS, but he was just like, pretend it's just a radio and the person from the person next to you head, that whatever's going on in your head is just the person next to you. And I was like, what? They wouldn't be thinking that. It's like all about me, right? So it's just like, it's actually just a radio, change the station or change the channel. But it's so much about these are mine. And then we blink, oh, why am I like this? Why am I like this? We've gotten all this programming and the systems and the structures. And we always don't have the knowledge of how to engage in the care that we need. You know, as someone who's had a lot of messages about my body directed at me, you know, messages from gender, how I should be showing up in the world. It's often hard to be in this fathom long body, to land here, to feel it, to feel the fullness of the body. And that's okay, because that's the perception of what I think it means to be in the body. I can be in the body even with like, oh, it's hard being in the body. That's being in the body. Huh. So the challenge can be part of it. And also, all right, this is how my mind works. And you'll begin to see this over the week. But this is where, for me, nature comes in. I love trees. And this is a great place to practice with trees. And so for me, like all of these commentary about human bodies or about my bodies, and then I go out and look at trees and I realize I don't have any of that commentary on trees. I don't go and look at that tree and be like, whoa, I can't believe you have wide limbs. And this other tree, like, ooh, you're tall and skinny. What are you doing that for? You know, I don't add all those projections, those perceptions on trees. I look at them and I think, oh, you must be leaning that way. Okay, you're leaning and you're going to support that. I just have all this beauty and this love for trees. And so I can realize when I look at trees that it's sight, and then I don't have that accompanying conditions. Of course, if you are an ecologist and you're studying them, you might look at them and begin to think in different ways. But for me, I realized that I don't have all that conditioning on trees that I do for my own body. And so I can unhook from some of those perceptions because I can relate like, whoa, you know, look at that. So when I get to those messages of like, this is not good, or this is good, this is bad, I can be like, oh, perception, judgment doesn't necessarily mean it's true. So we're with the Buddha's instructions, we're given these instructions, and then we're just showing up with them, with the Dharma, learning the way things are, cutting through these illusions that we have learned. So, just a recapping on the way to practice with the refuge of the Dharma. So, just this confidence that these teachings lead to freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. Freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. And I just led, that has brought, provided me so much inspiration. Just be like, wow, what would it be like if I was just a little less greedy? What would it be like if more people were just a little less greedy? What would it be like if there was less hate? What would it be like if I could uproot some of this hate that just arises? And delusion, what if I were less confused? I had more clarity. So that's like, sometimes I remember, okay, I don't know it all now, but this is where the teachings lead. And then the Dharma offers us these instructions. And so we're getting instructions in the meditation practices and how to engage in the retreat. And so sometimes it's just like, I'm not so sure about this one. But this is kind of where we can believe and we can offer some trust in the instructions. And knowing that for each of us, based on the causes and conditions of our life, we have to adjust the instructions because the middle path is just that. You know, we're all finding the middle from wherever we are. And then the third one about the Dharma is remembering that not all of our perceptions are accurate. I don't know how many are, but some of them are, because we got ourselves here and we're doing this together. So there are some that are accurate, but not all of them are. So when we get caught in those loops and start judging and we can just pause. You're like, maybe there's another way. And so we can come home to this body, this fathom-long body, as much as possible. Feeling into the whole of the body. And then sometimes when it's not possible because it just feels too constricted, we can open the lens and we can come home to nature. We can come home to the trees and the sky and the clouds and the birds. And we can be part of nature and hold the fullness there. And remembering that this fathom-long body is not separate. It's actually not separate from the natural world, as we were talking just the other day or this morning, whenever it was. So those are some practices of how we can actually practice with finding refuge in the Dharma. So the third refuge of Sangha, and this is community, and the community of practitioners will say, so all of us. And so this is where we come back to trees. So scientists used to think that trees were all competing with each other for nutrients, you know, that each tree was out there for themselves. I'm going to get it, and you get your own. And now research is showing that that is a frame of reference. That's a way of looking that is not actually true. And so the knowledge that the scientists were using to frame the questions themselves didn't allow them to ask the questions to have the answer that showed that trees were helping each other. And so this perception is based on scientists. Perhaps it was based on their conditioning. Perhaps it was based on the academy. If you've been in the university, maybe it was funding. You know, we don't know. Patriarchy, who knows what, why the scientists only were looking at that. Who knows why people took the knowledges of Darwin and filed it down to only looking at competition and not cooperation. because there have been in there, it's just sort of gotten ignored or in the footnotes. And most recently, an ecologist named Susan Simard has learned and studied and researched that trees communicate with each other and actually share resources. So she's done these studies where she put in, has an isotope so she can follow it, and we'll see that a tree will share their resources with another tree. And not only that, there's this whole network of mycorrhizal fungus underneath that supports this, that there's this mutualism between trees. And so, then because there's the forest wisdom or the mother tree is maybe what you can think of, the wood wide web, you heard that one. And so we know that some of this wisdom is not just recent from scientists, that it's really old indigenous wisdom that hasn't been seen or paid attention to, and now is being drawn to by the academy. And so we can use this knowledge and this understanding of cooperation to shape our relationship with Sangha. So we are in this field. We are in an energy field of the Sangha. All of us with our good intentions of showing up here and practicing, we practice together. And just imagining, what it would be like if you were, if there were, just the sense of like being by yourself somewhere and the different energy there would be. So we have this Sangha. And so sometimes, we think we want to just meditate, or that we're meditating all by ourselves. And that is a perspective, because we are kind of going inward and practicing in this fathom-long body. But remembering the fathom-long body is interconnected. And then there are all these humans here practicing with us. And we can also think of the Sangha as our ancestors. We can think of the Sangha as the ancestors of all those people in our lineage. We can also think of all the people in our own familial ancestry, our cultural ancestry. In my community, we say our transcestors, the trans ancestors, queer ancestors. Ancestors, thinking that we can bring forward all the beauty and we can actually heal some of the rifts. We can remember that we live in this interdependent web. And the other thing about that is that sometimes in community, it's easy for us to feel, I don't belong. Everyone else, but not me. Especially if those are the messages that we've got somewhere in our life. Sometimes it can really just land because we're not talking. So maybe that's what's happening. Maybe that's the message that goes. And that message is such a deep wounding. And we can even thinking about it, on the level of our interconnectedness of how we treat the planet. Because sometimes we don't care and we don't treat things well. And so it would make sense that we too don't always treat ourselves well. So when this message of like, I'm not belonging, it's not my place, just really allow yourself to bring as much kindness as possible to that thought. Because sometimes it is good to drop the thought, be like, oh, that's a perception. I don't need to think about that, and let it go. However, thinking of the river, and let the river take the thoughts, thinking of the clouds, let the clouds blow the thoughts. And sometimes we just need to hold our hand. Or if it's too much, like sometimes if I think of my inner child, I have to like hold my inner child out here because they're a little rascally. Or I'm like thinking I have my inner child and I'm riding on my bicycle and they're like on the back because I'm like, all right, I'm taking you with me, but you're going to stay back there. So, this place of sense of like, every one of us, each one of us is part of this Sangha and integral. We need all of us. We are so necessary for each other's survival. When I first started practicing, and I don't do so much anymore because I had a lot of body back injury. And I have a couple titanium hips and things like that. So I used to practice long, long days. and the beauty. And I love practicing late at night. And it's really amazing to go into the hall and there'll be two or three people there. And it's so remarkable because, like, I remember it in this 2-month retreat where I didn't ever meet those people. And yet they were so instrumental to my practice. It was my sangha, like, oh, here we are, you know, and be like, yay, thank you. I don't even know who they are, but yet here I am, and partly because of them. There's this quote, many of you might know Richard Aiken Roshi. He was a Zen practitioner, actually Hawaii, and he has an amazing verses, and this is one of them. And he says, when people praise me for something, I vow with all beings to return to my vegetable garden and give credit where credit is due. Right? I mean, we think that we're making all these mistakes, we're making all the things. We have to remember it. We're in this together. We are here together. So when we want to use this practice as a practice to support us in our day-to-day, the first one is to think about, how can I shift from me to we? So often I'm like, what's in this for me? Okay, what's in this for me? What can I get out of this? I'm going to squeeze that sponge and get everything out of it. And then thinking about, how can I be generous? How could I be generous? Sometimes it might be generous with, like, wow, I wish the window was closed just a little bit more. Maybe I'll get a blanket. Just be generous. So the other thing is this thought of, like, I'm not doing this alone. So when we feel like, oh, it's just me, we can think of our ancestors, we can think of our families, we can think of those friends of ours who would like to be here but can't because they're working or they have kids or you name it, why. So we can remember all the people that we're here with who aren't here. And then we can remember this sense of the interconnectedness of the Sangha that exists through time and space, and that we're practicing not just for ourselves, but we're part of this whole community of practitioners, remembering freedom. And as we think of these three refuges, we know that they are these separate parts, but they're not separate. They're actually really intertwined. And Thich Nhat Hanh, Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, amazing Vietnamese Zen master, says, without you, the Dharma cannot be practiced. Without you, the Dharma can't be practiced. It has to be practiced by someone. And then he says, without each of you, the Sangha cannot be. So we need you to practice the Dharma, and then together we are the Sangha. That is why when we say, I take refuge in the Buddha, we also hear, the Buddha takes refuge in me. I take refuge in the Dharma takes refuge in me. I take refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha takes refuge in me. I love just that turn of, like, what it means. Like, wow, I'm carrying that bowl. I am carrying the bowl. And so to encapsulate this sort of intertwining of these three, I want to share a simile, a couple of similes from the commentaries that Bhikkhu Bodhi expounded on. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a Theravadan monastic who also has done a lot of translations. And he says, one of the similes for the refuge compares the Buddha to a lotus flower. And those of you know that the lotus flower grows in the mud. So it's this beautiful flower, and yet it's based in the mud. And so he says that this simile is the Buddha, having grown up in the world, abides in the mist, untainted by the defilement. So it's in the mud, but it's, you know, it uses the richness of the mud, but it doesn't end up all tainted by it. And then the Buddha's teachings, the Dharma, is the fragrance of the lotus. So there's the beauty of the Buddha being the lotus flower, and then the fragrance is the teachings. And that they're available to all. Anybody who walks or is in the presence of the flower gets the teachings. And then the Sangha is the bees, you know, that fly around the flower. And they're the ones that they collect all of this great stuff from the lotus flower. And then they go back to their hive and they make the transform it into honey. So that's kind of like what we're doing. You know, we are getting the Dharma. We're taking the teachings. We're bringing it in. We're transforming it, transforming ourselves, transforming our community. And I love this image of the lotus because Thich Nhat Hanh, you probably have seen this, no mud, no lotus. You know, the pithy saying of no mud, no lotus. And so like when things get really like, you know, you feel like, okay, I'm in the compost bin. You know, you can be like, okay, that's the mud. We need the mud. We need the mud. And this is another place of perception. My sister, who is an ecologist, has told me time and time again how she hates the phrase drain the swamp, which in the U.S. is often applied to politics, that the politics is a swamp that needs to be drained. And she says, what are we doing when we are perpetuating this idea that we need to drain the swamps? Wetlands in the United States are disappearing. People drained like over, I think, 80 or 90% of the wetlands in the United States. And so if we have this perception of draining the swamp to make something nice on top of it, we actually are losing this beautiful protection. Wetlands are some of the most diverse ecosystems there are. And not only that, those of us who have been down to Santa Cruz and we know the marshes, and the marshes are like the nurseries. That's the places where the sharks will come in, and then they have the safety, and they get flooded with the tides every day. And so you're in this flow. It's not always easy, but it's protected. So, and I don't know about you, I grew up on the East Coast by some marshes, and the smell of the salt marsh, it is something else. And it's just so amazing because it's very, very pungent, but you kind of come to love it. At least I did. And it's really amazing because there can be that beauty in the capacity to transform. You know, the capacity that there's no separation between that mud and the lotus flower. And that's where the Buddha is in the mud, not transcending it. We aren't transcending this messy body. We're practicing right here. And then Thich Nhat Hanh, to continue with the no mud, no lotus, says, most people are afraid of suffering, but suffering is a kind of mud to help the lotus flower of happiness grow. There can be no lotus flower without the mud. So most people are afraid of suffering, but suffering is a kind of mud to help the lotus flower of happiness grow. There can be no lotus flower without the mud. So there's a realm that we sometimes talk about, like I mentioned with the beginning, the Deva realm, which is supposed to be like this really beautiful realm. And the problem with that realm is that you actually can't wake up in it. That the human realm is thought to be the most amazing realm because we have the capacity to wake up. And I always had a little bit of skepticism about this, but in the Buddhist suttas, it said that being a human, the chance of being reborn as a human is the same as a blind turtle going up from the bottom of the ocean and finding its way through like a big yoga circle on the top of the ocean. And that's how precious it is to be a human. Like, that's the chance. I was like, really? It doesn't seem that fun from here. This is really what they're saying? This is like, you won the lottery? You're a human? I'm like, wow. And one of my retreats, I went in, I was like, I think I'd just rather be a rock. You know, like that seems like the red rock. Can I be a red rock in the desert? They're really beautiful. You know, eons I could be there being weathered in some sculpture. Instead, I have to be a human, deal with all these other humans. Yikes. And yet, this capacity to wake up, to break out of the delusion of separateness, to be with ourselves just as we are, bringing ourselves into this wholeness, into this way of being, you know, transforming, as the metaphor said, like all of this teachings into the honey, into that nectar. So, just thinking about this practice and how we engage in it, and using practices that support us to hold us in the day-to-day, because this continuity of showing up for yourself and showing up for each other as best as we can, that's it. And the more that we can be right here and meeting the moment fully in this fathom-long body, in this fathom-long body of nature, in this fathom-long body of the Sangha, we can see through all these forces that have been moving us. We can see when we're on the right path. We can feel that sense of like, oh yeah. We can wobble a little bit like, ooh, okay. And we'll begin to have this inner wisdom that can shine through, that lotus that comes up out of the mud. And knowing that it's challenging. There is this suffering that will arise again and again. We bring as much kindness in as we can. Kindness to know that we're not alone on this path, that others have walked this path before us, that we're not separate. And that generosity, the generosity of heart, to lift us beyond our judging mind, that tendency for comparing, and open up to the possibility of beauty that exists. So thank you for your kind attention.